Good morning and welcome back to Planet Waves, ongoing coverage of the United Astrology Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. It is Sunday morning, May 29th. I believe it is the third or fourth day of the conference officially, though we really got underway last Wednesday, actually, with pre-conference activities. And over the past few days, I've been interviewing many of the people who are here at the conference. Some are presenters and some are just folks who've come to study at the conference. And we've had some actually excellent learning experiences with all of the above. I am joined in our studio this morning by Simon Chikoisky and Nomi Gallo, who are both with the Ayurvedic Institute in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Ayurveda is, I guess, what you might call the master science of well-being coming out of India. I don't know if that's an appropriate way to say it, but it is a broad umbrella that covers many aspects of living and many approaches to living, ranging from what you eat and what your body type is, to philosophical topics, to a branch of astrology, which is also a branch of as it is in the West, but not usually recognized as such, a branch of a much larger, comprehensive viewpoint in the world. So anyway, good morning, Nomi and Simon. Welcome to Planet Waves FM.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
All right. So we had we seem to have found an interesting conversation about the what approach to take. Being Vedic astrologers and Vedic practitioners working in the United States predominantly, right?
Correct.
So you're bringing an Eastern perspective, an Eastern viewpoint into probably the most Western country, the country that sort of invented modern Westernism and all of its attachment to everything for everyone, basically here in the United States, and so you're really involved in this process of bringing Eastern ideas into a very dense Western culture.
But it's a very good mix, because part of the process of the Vedic Vidya, the body of knowledge, coming to the West has made the country of its origin appreciated more. Because they say, oh, if America likes it, it must be good.
So there's been a reflection effect.
Indeed.
Which has been going on all century, really, since the... whose rival do you count it with? Who was the first mirror?
Well, Vivekananda was a great yogi who came to the U.S. At the turn of the 20th century, who pretty much, with his speech in Chicago, made yoga known to the West. He just sort of blew us away.
Right. When does he come over? And what is his name again?
Vivekananda.
Vivekananda.
Correct.
Okay.
The bliss of discriminative intelligence is what his name means in Sanskrit.
Yes. Okay. And does he predate Yogananda's arrival in Los Angeles?
Quite a bit.
Quite a bit, by 10 or 20 years or something like that?
Vivekananda, I believe, gave his first speech before 1900. It was 1890. Nomi?
1890s, I don't remember exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so there's a long history of this. And Blavatsky is involved also. She brings over Gurdjieff.
Correct.
In the 19th century, right? That happens in the 19th century, right?
Right around the same time.
Yeah. So Vivekananda is part of a movement that's happening that seems maybe to be a kind of a plan to spiritualize the West a little bit, to put us back in contact with something that might have been lost in the past? Or is there a larger purpose operating here, do you think? Or just
always. I think that we as humans cannot always be aware of the full plan. I think mostly one of the things that the Vedas teach to me is that there's always so much more than I can understand. So there's a level of faith in the tradition that's coming through, that there's always a larger plan.
Right.
And the teacher sends their student, and they go. And it's not much more complicated at times.
There's also the sense that the body of knowledge itself is revered as a person, as a vidya, and it has its own, a mind of its own. So, for example, when you practice Vedic astrology, the Jyotish Vidya comes and talks to you, or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how good of a vehicle you are for it.
The muse, as it were.
The muse, exactly. This
right.
is
the as Lily put it, there's some spirit or genius behind the astrology.
Indeed.
Pretty I think quickly anyone sensitive would start to figure out that they're in a conversation with something on the other side of the chart, I think, paying attention.
And we can look at it in a very concrete way. There's something inside of the cell, an intelligence, that comes in and says, separate, and the cell separates. There's no other explanation than just that there is an intelligence that tells the cell to separate. It does. The cell that is created has an intelligence of what it is, and that intelligence tells it what to do, and it does that thing. Mm-hmm. The cell is born, it realizes it is a liver cell, and it functions as a liver cell.
Right.
And that is an intelligence that we can't have, that we don't have a really good, powerful description of how that works.
Nor do we tend to apply it to bodies of knowledge or discarnated entities, usually here in the United States. You know, you might believe that grandma's ghost is helping you out, but that's not necessarily considered a discrete body of knowledge with a life of its own. Maybe it is in the case of a very faithful person who grandma keeps coming back to and guiding, but that would kind of be the exception to the rule rather than the rule. Things without bodies tend to not be regarded as real, and so the body of knowledge that's this living archetype of Vedic astrology, you build a relationship with it, and you find out that it's real, I think, or any method.
And the word that you're saying repeatedly is knowledge, and there's a distinction between the knowledge and the information. The information can be the 1, 2, 3, how I go through the chart, 1, 2, 3, how I understand a person's constitution, a formula. But the knowledge of what the data is telling us, the houses, the planets, the associations, the yogas, the qualities, the doshas, what that data is telling us becomes something because of knowledge, not because of information. So this vidya, this inner teacher that is coming through ages, coming through tradition, coming through knowledge, this is what's guiding the data. Because the data is data, statistics. They can be read in any way, really.
Yeah, including all the commentaries by all the other astrologers. That's just different from the source material, from the source inspiration.
Absolutely.
Now, you were saying before we went on the air that one of the differences in the Eastern practices is that the practitioner is a vehicle, considered to be a vehicle, and the vehicle requires preparation. Unlike, for example, in the United States, where you might be able to go to a couple of conferences and read a couple of books and then call yourself an astrologer without the preparation of your vehicle, not just the learning.
Correct.
That seems to be a useful concept to introduce to those who are embarking in this work.
One of the prerequisites of being taken as a student, the word for student in Sanskrit is shishya. There are many words for student, but the word shishya means cultured. So the idea is, even in the Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna is teaching Arjuna, Arjuna says, I am your shishya, means I'm ready to learn. I have been cultured in the ways of the world. I have done my practices. I'm basically a clean vessel. Fill me up. And the role of a shishya is to embody that knowledge, and it's also to know more than just astrology. For example, if you go to India and you say, I'm an astrologer, what's the first thing that's going to happen? They're going to stick out their hand and say, okay,
interesting.
Tell me about my chart. Because astrology is more than reading a piece of paper. In fact, in ancient India, there were no Swiss watches. You didn't have birth times with, you know, Swiss, with Timex accuracy.
Yes.
So you had to learn to read. The whole body is a chart. The face of a person is a chart. And this isn't too far from what artists and poets, even in our culture, know. You look at The Simpsons. Homer Simpson is drawn in a certain way that reflects his character. He has short arms, for example. When you see short arms in a person, it means a short temper. They're quick to be risen to anger. You know, he has a certain shape of a face. Marge, his wife, I mean, I don't know why the Simpsons are coming through, but there you go, has very long arms, and she's the
patient
one.
She's the patient one.
She's the patient one.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn, you know, even as a Vedic astrologer or as an Ayurvedic practitioner, as Nomi is, you learn to use other sciences. You learn to bring in other modes of information. So your reading is enriched.
Aleister Crowley, who I think of as the illegitimate father of American astrology, owing to his relationship with Evangeline Adams, ghostwriting some of her books and so forth. And anyway, Crowley suggested that anyone wanting to practice what he called the magical arts, you know, these kind of arts, forget if it's really magic, but I know what he meant. He suggested that you be proficient in logic, that you have another language, that you speak a second language, that you be proficient in athletics to the point where you can compete in one sport, that you be proficient in one science where you can perform an experiment in that one science as a means of being a well-rounded practitioner with some grounding in the world, which I thought was a pretty good idea. And I did my best to follow it as best I could when I encountered it.
And this is the classical view. This is not just Indian. This is ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. You want to add to that?
Please.
I mean, this is the classical view of regardless of the tradition you search. You have to be a fit vehicle. And in body, mind, and spirit.
Yes.
There's an old 1900s actor named Antonin Artaud, and he also believed that the theater was a spiritual science and that all actors had to be athletes. And I think that when people come to us as Vedic astrologers or Ayurvedic practitioners or practitioners of yoga, they are looking for somebody that they are emulating. They're looking for someone with health. They're looking for somebody who can see them without judgment. They're looking for somebody who can explain them in a way that they can understand, they can reason, and they can then grow to make appropriate choices. I feel that my whole job is to almost lead by example, as well as educate enough so that the person that is in front of me can go out into the world and make a choice. And they have a way of making the choice. And the choice makes sense. So the idea that there is logic, I think that that is absolutely true. I think that when you're bringing the ideas and the philosophies of the East into the West, one of the things that we're doing is looking at the broad understanding of that logic and not bringing the ornaments. We're not bringing the distracting...
The accoutrements.
Exactly.
Of spirituality.
Exactly.
The thing that you wear in the mala. And
right.
The,
that's a different tradition. And it
is
a tradition.
Yeah, the gypsy kind of... Well, nothing against gypsies. Some of them are good readers. But it's a different tradition, and it's an external view, mainly. The accoutrements are an external view, and what... this work is about an internal perspective.
Absolutely. And those broader understandings, they are logical within the natural world. They may not be so logical to when a doctor's come out and the scientists come out and say, you should eat this and not that, you should eat this and not that. It might not be logical in that scenario, but that's not a natural scenario. That's a laboratory. And the backstory of the laboratory has a lot to do with the findings. Where the natural world is looking at, when I'm really hot, if I stand in the middle of the sun at the peak of the afternoon, I'm going to become more hot. So if I'm having an issue with being really hot, chances are I would probably prefer to do moon bathing instead of sunbathing.
Right.
We're going to apply cool to hot. We would apply... oily to rough. If you continue to apply the same principles, just like Einstein says, you continue to try the same things over and over and expect a different result, it's a sign of insanity. So the natural world is taking it's a logical point of view. It's very, very rational. And once we can accept the simplicity of it, then it opens up into the extreme exquisiteness, its elegance. And at first it can seem daunting, but maintaining the simplicity of that natural logic, I think, is the first step.
Yes. So applying that to the idea of preparation, let's say we're talking to a number of people who are hoping to be astrologers or to use their astrology knowledge better, what would you suggest as some of that preparation? And how do you know
find
when
a teacher?
How do you know when you're ready? Well, find a teacher. Yes, that's a good one to have a focal point of guidance.
Yeah,
and studies. Yes,
and I think he means also a singular teacher. The Vedas are interested very much in tradition.
A singular one teacher, meaning
rather than 25 teachers. I'm going to go to this. I'm going to go to that. I'm going to go to this because everyone's teaching is coming through tradition. So mixing traditions in the beginning can be potentially very confusing.
In the interest of learning the basics of one tradition so that you have an understanding of it, rather than our, I think, one of our distinctly American kind of melange styles of learning.
Well, shopping.
This isn't...
It is a kind of shopping, isn't it?
You know, I wouldn't want to second guess the Vedic Vidya. This body of knowledge has come to the West for a reason.
Yep.
And this is not to say that the what we're calling the Western way is all bad. Let's trash the West because whatever. There is validity to being independent, having your own mind, and being able to pick and choose. At a certain point, when you want to go deeper, then you... you know, then you look for someone who can lead you there. But the same yogi that I mentioned, Vivekananda, he said we have to revise smriti and reinterpret shruti. What this means is smriti is man-made knowledge, man-made laws. They have to be revised for our time. This is a confirmation. There you go. Amen to that. God says amen to that.
There's this antique telephone next to
our
studio.
We are ready to be taken out of the Matrix.
Yep, you've got Planet Waves FM. Hi, how can I help you? Yeah, why don't you come down? You know, you've reached a lobby phone, and I'm actually on the radio right now. But if you come to the second floor, they'll give you a lot of information.
Is it Neo?
Yes. Yeah, but worth it. It's really interesting. You'll like it. Bless. Bye for now. When you set up a desk, people come to you for information, but I don't know how they got transferred to this number.
Oh, very interesting.
So the phone rang at the moment you were saying
that
about revising mankind's law because we have outdated laws.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fundamental difference between modern Western tradition, and astrology specifically, and the ancient traditions like Vedic astrology is that practitioners of Vedic astrology are basically doing the same thing using the same techniques that were used 2,000 or 3,000 years ago.
Right.
There is a continuity of tradition. Now, there is a great benefit to that. However, there is also the tendency to get stuck. And so what Vivekananda was warning us against was this tendency to get stuck.
Yes.
And in India, I mean, look at the caste system. The origin of the caste system is something very beautiful. There are these five Vedic archetypes. The warrior, whose role is to protect that which cannot protect itself. The educator, who is a teacher, priest, or counselor. The merchant, who is designed to produce and move goods and services. The laborer, who is the foundation of society, the worker, and the outsider. But over the last several thousand years, this has been perverted into a hierarchical system where one type usurps the power and says, I'm the best. So what he's warning us against is this type of static interpretation. We need to reinvigorate.
Have a living, moving interpretation of the
exactly.
tradition because we're interacting with the tradition. We're influencing it as much as it is influencing us.
Yes, while maintaining what is true in it, while not throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, and that's a process of elimination and trial and error and bringing in things that are in affinity in the modern world and also recognizing that we're contributing as we do it. And it's important to be faithful in that process, I think. You write a book on something, you write a blog post, you've influenced things, and, you know, God only knows who's going to read it. Anybody could read it, and all kinds of people do.
It's the razor's edge.
Yes.
You walk the razor's edge.
Yeah, and my way of handling that is to have an affinity to a higher good, a greater ethos than just to astrology itself. I'm using astrology as a tool, as a vehicle to serve, mm-hmm. however you want to say what that thing is that I am in service of, and so I can therefore direct my questions in that direction, and I can go to a level of ethics to resolve a question or an issue that I might have that might not be able to be worked out through the internal machinations of the system.
Ultimately, the goal of this is to make you a better person. See, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it says, the foundational book on yoga, it says that there are five states of mind, and you can become expert at a thing. You know, we have our Michael Jordans, we have our astronauts who are expert at their skill, but they're not necessarily good people. And what he says is, yoga will make you expert, but beyond that, its goal is to make you a good person. So you practice astrology, you practice Ayurveda, you practice dance, whatever your art is, to express yourself and do your dharma, but fundamentally, it's your way to evolve into something higher.
Isn't that dharma? I mean, isn't that the practice of dharma that gets you to evolve, that orientation?
Dharma, and yet so many of us don't know what our dharma is. We have a dharma to, we have an obligation, a duty to our society, to our body, how to take care of the body, mm-hmm. but there is something in your heart, like T.S. Eliot, the naming of cats, you know, that cat has a secret name inside that only it knows. And that's like your secret dharma. And if you express that, you step into the fullness of who you are. But if you don't, the Gita says, Shreyan svadharmo vigunaha paradharma svanushtetat. It's better to be bad at what you do than good at what is bad for you. Meaning, better be bad at your own dharma than trying to live someone else's life.
Yes.
And that's the goal of these ancient sciences, not just the Vedic, but you know, in Greece and in Rome and in Scandinavian cultures, embrace your path. And God, love, relationships, money are on your path. You don't have to go looking for them through whatever technique or skill. They are on your path. Your job is to find your path. Would you agree with that?
I would, and I would add that the sciences, they're the tools in order to find the path. Because it is through the clarity of mind, clarity of body, the strength of body, the assimilation of mind, body, and spirit, that the path is revealed. And once you can use these tools to find that path, then you can use the tools to remain as with as much integrity to that path as you have, as there is possible.
Yes. Yeah, we find usually things through methods of approach.
For instance,
yes.
If a person is sick, and the person, and maybe not sick with some terrible illness, but maybe the person doesn't digest their food very well. And because they don't digest their food very well, their arteries are clogged, right? The blood of life is not getting into the tissues as well as it could. Mm-hmm. The gut is not really working properly. This gives us a sour feeling. This stuckness in our body becomes a stuckness in our outlook and in our life. And when we have a stuckness, then we have an attachment to something, and we believe that something in particular is supposed to occur. And we work for that. But we don't have enough clarity to see and appreciate this concept of what we should be doing and be okay with whatever that is. Sometimes it means that people don't like you very much, and then sometimes it means that people do. But at any rate, it's about following that path that feels, that you can feel is right. If the body is clogged, it can't feel rightness. It can't feel with clarity. So the Ayurveda is really helping the person on this physical body realm, cleaning out the channels. The yoga is helping to further clear the channels so that the prana and the information, the chi, whatever you want to call it, that which brings from the outside inside, this knowledge, moves it through the body. And then astrology comes in and helps to focus this trajectory on the person so that they can allow their mind, now that it's clearing, to go into a direction and see what's going on. It can help remedy things that are maybe so intangible that we can't figure out why something doesn't work on the physical level. So astrology comes in and helps to remove those, that stickiness that we can't quite put our fingers on.
Sounds like Ketu.
Could be. It depends on everything else.
A description of the quality of Ketu, the stickiness that you can't put your fingers on, but that you can sort of feel, but you don't know where you picked it up.
Wherever Ketu is in your chart, there will be a void of that house. So if Ketu is in your second house, there will be a void in that area of your life. Ketu indicates... Ketu is smoke, represented as smoke or lack. So Ketu in the second house, no money.
That's it. You're stuck.
No.
There
is
no.
So how do you work? How do you work? When is the end? Or how do you work in the Vedic tradition that you use? How do you work that that quality to resolve the matter of Ketu, the south node of the moon?
Well, look. When I look at you, Eric, I see a line on your hand that says wanderlust, the desire to travel, to be on the road. I also see independence from the way your family thought. You don't accept the rules laid down by your mom and dad. You're an independent thinker. How do you express that? This is where free choice comes in. But I'm presuming, because your hand is mostly closed, but there are two lines that I see there that indicate that.
It's a pretty good reading. I come in and out of the wanderlust.
Yeah.
You know, I also have a lust for home.
You could.
I have a deep need to connect with the ground
on
the ground that I call home.
Radio is voice, so
yes.
It's the subtlest, concrete essence. You're on the internet instead of the primetime radio, so this is not uniforming to the status quo.
Yes.
You are traveling into different realms and having interview with people that you don't know. So even if you stayed at home, in a home that
yes.
you owned.
Yes, I get you.
Under the ground.
I'm still working that property. There's still an international property and diversity and a lot of ninth house themes, yes.
No, but I mean this in a literal sense, too. Mm-hmm. He could have been a truck driver. But every mm-hmm. truck driver always comes back home. But anyway, the point is, your question was about Ketu, that you have to look at the rest of the chart, nothing in isolation. And
yes.
Now let's bash Western, the Western thing a little bit, is that we isolate. Whereas in the Vedic...
Integrates,
but also you reduce to irreducible principles. For example, mm-hmm. they took all the variegated complexity of natural phenomena and reduced them to five principles: air, water, fire, earth, and space. And so space... So earth is solidity. The water element is everything that's liquid. Fire is things in their transformative state. Air is... the gaseous state, and space is the nuclear state. In that reduction, this is akin to Einstein's E equals MC squared, or F equals MA. It's a simple formula that has tremendous implications, but that on the surface is very easy to grasp. So there is a way that the ancients did things that they made things apparently simple while holding the complexity of what those formulae represented in a way that you could go deep and access them without compartmentalizing, without dissecting, without the need to dissect. To find out about the frog, you can look at the frog as a whole and know it without necessarily dissecting.
Yeah, and observe its behavior.
Correct.
As much as you observe its organs, I think that the tendency that we have is to cut it open and see what's going on in there, as opposed to watch it for 10 years and see what it does. So it depends on the science. Some people like to watch frogs talk to each other.
Both are useful,
yep, but for different things.
Correct.
You know, yes.
Yeah.
All right, so where do we go from here?
Well, where do we go from
here? I can propose something.
Okay, please.
Please.
Well, I would like to keep focused on the preparation for the work topic, because I think that right before the conference, I issued a kind of a manifesto of what is missing from the teaching of astrology. And, you know, we're doing therapy here. We don't like to say that, and there's laws in some locales against calling this therapy and doing therapy without a license. But in effect, astrologers are working as therapists. But there is very little training for how to do that, and very little concept of what that is. And so among other suggestions, I suggested that we bring more non-astrologer therapists to our conferences and have them teach, and a number of other modes of preparation for what we really need to be doing. Even like if you're going to write, be a fact checker. Fact check your own writing, for example. My class on Wednesday was a writing class. I taught a writing class, and that's one of the things I feel is missing from the preparation of most astrologers is communication skills. What would you add from your viewpoint and your observation in the years that you've been working are some accessible skills that those who are on the path of learning esoteric knowledge and technique do to deepen their ability to be actually connected and practicing in a safe way, in a helpful way?
Okay, I'm a very simplistic person, so I always have to take such a huge question down into what I would see as its most basic part. And in this question, the thing that jumps out to me is this concept of relationship. When a person functioning as an astrologer or a practitioner or a counselor of any kind, whether it's cards or palms or charts or pulse, whatever, that person and the client, they're in a relationship.
Yep.
And within that relationship, there is information that is passed in both directions. And there is knowledge that is passed in both directions. And the therapist or the astrologer or however they are referred, the one who is passing knowledge from the vidya to the client, that person, I think, needs to be to truly understand the importance of karma. This idea that you can take karma or not means when I am in relationship with somebody, they do not take from me, and I do not take from them. I do not take their sorrow or their pain, or I take nothing. I remember very little about most of my clients, and it means that I have to always be going back into the chart, always going back into the pulse, because I don't keep that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I see take on the pain and unhappiness, and in other words, the karmas of their clients. And why in the world would we want to take on more karma?
We certainly have enough, having arrived here with it.
We're here, so we clearly have our own. And to take on somebody else's means that we are now in charge of them. A person who takes the karma of somebody else is responsible for that person and their karma and their choices. And the truth is, none of us, as astrologers or Ayurvedic practitioners or doctors or therapists or anything else, are really ever in charge or responsible for their client or patient. The, you know, traditional guru shishya, in those situations, those can be quite different. But in
where the guru takes on the karma,
takes on or away, it depends. It's a much bigger subject, but this
mitigates in some way.
But this doesn't apply to that relationship.
Yes.
This is different because our task is not to take the karma. Our task is to relay the knowledge from vidya to client.
Vidya, again, is
the teacher of the knowledge,
The living entity in the background of the astrology, sort of the spirit, the genius,
exactly.
Or spirit that Lily described.
The intelligence, as you
yes.
said, the uh-huh. intelligence. So I think that in terms of preparation, one of the big things that is missing from schools and training, besides personal health, is this concept of you're really not helping somebody if you're just taking away the pain. You're not changing their course. You're not helping them try to find their dharma. You're just giving them a reason to come back to you, because they feel good when they leave, because they get to drop all their junk off in your door, and now you are in pain and you are suffering from that, and you can no longer serve because you are now too polluted to receive that information appropriately. We have to get rid of those things because they produce screens that we can no longer see clearly through.
Yep. Yeah, and this is, you know, this is basic. At least in therapy training, they tell you what transference and countertransference are. Those are not assets. They're just things that can happen. They're projections that the helper and the helpee put onto one another, or tend to put onto one another. And you have to be pretty good at it to be able to have the Teflon coating to let that stuff not contact you.
And there are a lot of techniques, but that's where coming through a good teacher, because the teacher is going to teach you the techniques
to model that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, the models I had were not astrologers for the most part, though I had some very good astrology teachers I was modeling long before I came to astrology. And I figured that out, and I, you know,
so you're would not, encourage you're not that. Poor then?
No, I'm not poor.
Good.
No, I'm
most astrologers are poor.
Yeah, right. I cannot understand that either. I mean, usually when you're a pretty good astrologer, you will have more business beating down your door.
It's about abundance. So if you're taking on an abundance of karmas, who needs money?
We have to eat, though.
There's a myth, there's a story in ancient India that says back sometime in the remote past, astrologers became so good. In fact, they were writing the horoscopes of people who would come 500 years ahead of them. And I've seen one of those horoscopes. It was mine. It's amazing. They tell your mother's and father's name. How the heck do they know that? This is called Nadi Jyotish. But they became so good that the gods or the entities in heaven cursed them to be only 70% correct at best and to always be poor. So this is the modern astrologer's excuse. I'm poor because our race of astrologers has been cursed. So you have to really do it for love first,
I would say.
Yeah. So I was being facetious about your models being astrologers, and yet you're doing okay.
No, no, I'm saying I've modeled off of musicians and therapists and other teachers. I mean, I've learned. I mean, I don't have a very high opinion of our profession. I will say that, and it is one of the reasons why I am in a teaching role and in a repertorial role, and I have the ability to comment on that, but. In my observation, there are very few astrologers who really know what they're doing. And it's very easy in the United States to become one having no clue what you're doing.
Well, think about how long it takes to become a doctor. You go to, you know, undergrad 4 years and another 4 or 5, 6 years. Really.
Residency, internship, yes. And that makes that's easy by comparison to astrology. Now, to be a good doctor, you need to be in practice. You need to be a little old, I think,
right.
Or, you know, unless you're going to be a really good Botox kind of person. But it's the practice that makes it. It's not skill, and developed by many years of encountering unique situations.
Exactly, and in the sacred texts that teach Ayurvedic physicians, they say a doctor has to have 4 skills. They have to have skill. You need talent.
But you mean like steady hands to be a surgeon,
for example? Yes. You need to be well versed in the knowledge. You have to go to school.
Yes.
Then you need experience, and there's a spiritual element to it as well. But the first one they say is you need the talent. You need to be able. Daksha means skillfulness.
Daksha.
Yeah, daksha means skill. Mm-hmm. The ability to perform that art. So. Right.
In the way that can't really be learned but can only be brought out.
Right. So right. No matter, and cleanliness is another one, but no matter how many showers you take and how many books you read and how long you go to school, if you don't have that skill, you'll never, you know, really cut the mustard.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a good message to be putting out there, I think. It's a good reminder to be hearing.
However, for self-knowledge, it is absolutely... it's one of the best ways to learn about yourself and to grow as a person.
Yes, astrology as a path of self-knowledge. Yeah, yeah. That was on my manifesto of things that we need to focus on as a particular skill of astrologers. I think most people are drawn in out of a quest for self-knowledge.
And when I say astrology, you know, I mean the wider umbrella. Palmistry is part of astrology. Mm-hmm. You know, iridology, reading the eyes. Nomi, for example, is a master at reading the face. She can tell you practically your whole health history by looking at your face.
Mm-hmm.
Reading signs and symbols, and even the phone call from God we just got, you know, 20 minutes ago, means something mm-hmm. if you have a matrix in which to, you know, fit it.
Yes. And astrology, among its other gifts, is a very good matrix. It's a system of organization. It's kind of like a very advanced computer for assembling and integrating different bodies of knowledge. When you think about all the things you need to do contemporary astrology, you need a knowledge of astronomy. You need a knowledge of philosophy. You should know what's happened, the story of therapy in the 20th century and what that became. Freud and Jung on out to the modern human potential movement therapists. We're drawing on all of that in what we do, and then you can keep making the list. You know, you have to have a sense of current events because people are impacted by them, and we're in such interesting times. So it takes a lot of patience to do any of these healing arts well, I think. Patience to learn and
Amen.
Learn and learn and learn.
And there's there's a shloka in Sanskrit that says, Amantra maksharam nasti, nasti mulam anoshadam, ayogya purusho nasti, yojakas tatra durlabam, which means there is no sound that doesn't have a meaning. There is no plant that doesn't have medicinal value. There is no person who is born without a purpose. But it takes skill to find these things. It takes someone yes. who is skilled to see that.
Yes, and as someone said recently, I wish I remember who it was, that there's a difference between a sense of purpose and a sense of mission.
Mm.
And I am noticing that as the world heats up and more people are being called into some form of participation or service, that purpose mission issue is coming up for people, that there's chaos now and a corresponding sense of disconnect internally. And I'm noticing that there is a resonance with witness the chaos, connect internally, and then be able to participate in a more meaningful way. You know, and we're, you know, Uranus and Pluto are going to make 7 squares beginning in 1 month from yesterday, right? 7's going to be 7. That's a lot of chaos rising, and to hoist up our sails and use that's going to take some centered, loving trust.
Hold on to your pants.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bumpy ride.
So you're good on bumpy but adventurous. I think that if you are open to change and... not necessarily just clinging to the past. I mean, I think the chaos factor has a lot to do with clinging to the past.
I agree. I like to stay away from terms that have a certain judgment resonance. As you say chaos, I hear potential. And I, you know, there can be a lot of very difficult alignments. And one of the things that we learn through loss is how to be free. So I think maybe part of the groundedness is to see the quality and the nature of things rather than the judgment that's placed on top, because that's just part of the details.
Right. Yeah, I actually didn't have a pejorative on chaos. I think of chaos as being fertile.
Oh, and that's the mythology.
An opening.
Of Uranus. What happens when Uranus gets his testicles cut off? You know, the semen falls into the ocean and Venus is born.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it doesn't get, you know, pretty more direct than that. Mm-hmm. There is creativity and creation out of chaos and mm-hmm. out of innovation and revolution. And this is what this aspect speaks of, is revolution. People
yes.
wanting freedom.
Yes.
And we saw this in the Arab Spring. We're seeing this in, you know, the Tea Party and the 99% in the U.S. These are real...
Liberation movements, yes.
Yeah, and this is real stuff. Astrology isn't just about you're a good person. it's okay to think the things you think. That's fine on a psychological level, but it has real physical impact. In fact, the only reason it survived 5,000 years is that kings and queens and you know, in the old days, it wasn't for the lay person. This was to predict weather patterns, when to sow the crops, when to go to war. And if the astrologer was wrong, you know, they were beheaded, or they were, you know,
there or was, the country suffered consequences. The people didn't eat if they were wrong. And so there's a knowledge of the natural order.
Yeah, and by the
necessary
Darwinian sort of weeding out of the bad genes,
yes,
astrology would have been dead long ago if it didn't have a real practical material use.
Yes, well, it's really practical. It's a very practical art.
And ultimately, it's about your everyday life and how to live your everyday life in finance, in relationships, and in your relationship to the divine.
Yes, and then we bring in the non-ordinary states with these outer planets and these other kinds of missions that are now being integrated into the Western system, at least. All these things out on the edge past Saturn...
It's always growing.
...are different than what you normally would do in your normal everyday life. Pluto's a little bit different story. Not everyone's revolutionary or has that tendency, but we do seek freedom in some parts of our life, and that...
And we live in a global society. We are affected by what's happening in Greece,
you know, we are.
And we're affected by what's happening even in outer space.
Yes,
you can't isolate yourself from your environment, and that's the lesson that the outer planets have to teach us.
Excellent, Nomi Gallo, Simon Chikoisky from the Ayurvedic Institute in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you for being guests on Planet Waves FM.
Thank you, Eric.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
All right. You are listening to Planet Waves FM's ongoing coverage of the United Astrology Conference here in New Orleans, Louisiana. We'll be back with another presentation shortly. Stay in touch.